everything but the book back into her purse. The bar had filled up since they'd arrived. Single men with exposed chest hair chatting up women with exposed cleavage. The room teetered a little, and Virginia placed both hands on the bar to steady herself. She glanced down quickly at her own chest to make sure that her bra hadn't slid up again. With only one breast, there was nothing to hold the other side in place. The woman at the specialty shop who'd sold her the bra had promised it would look completely natural, but Virginia wasn't so sure. Betsy stared with concern. The only friend Virginia had told about her operation was Samantha. If Samantha were here, Virginia would have a different story to tell. But Sam had moved to California just as Virginia's life was imploding. Sure, they tried to speak on the phone once a week, but long-distance phone calls were expensive. Their letters had trailed off, which was to be expected, really. A holiday card at Christmas was probably the best Virginia could hope for at this point. Virginia picked up the book Betsy had left on the bar, diverting her attention. "What's this?" "It's the spring auction catalog for Sotheby Park Burnett. Take a look. There's a ton of great art in there." Virginia leafed through, pretending to consider the possibilities. "Really great." She handed it back to her. "Are you going anywhere for the holidays?" Always a safe question. Betsy made a face. "I'd rather go to Europe, but Cliff is insisting we go somewhere warm for Christmas. He just got us a suite at the Habitation Leclerc in Haiti." Betsy's voice rose in both volume and pitch, either to make herself heard above the crowd or to impress those seated nearby. "It's where Bianca Jagger goes, apparently. And you? I hope you get some time off. Ruby and I were just talking about hitting the slopes. Maybe Tahoe this year." As if they could afford the airfare, never mind the cost of a hotel. What a joke. "Oh, dear." Betsy put a hand up to her lips. "I think we may have taken your skis. How awful. I can give them back if you need them." "What?" For a moment, Virginia thought she'd misheard. The ski equipment was stored up in their country house in northern Westchester. Officially Chester's country house these days. Back when Ruby was young, they'd go up every weekend to let her explore the garden, take family hikes in the woods out back. She fondly remembered sitting under the porch, holding Ruby in her lap, and listening to the raindrops tap on the leaves. Betsy leaned in. "Chester had a big estate sale a couple of months ago. Didn't he tell you he's selling the house?" "Oh, right, I forgot." Virginia steeled herself. He hadn't told her. Not that he was required to anymore. "Everything was laid out in the driveway. Pretty much everybody from the street stopped by. It almost became a kind of party." Virginia stiffened at the thought of the detritus of their marriage strewn across the driveway for the neighbors to pick through. The skis, the water guns, the slip and slide that Ruby had played with summer after summer. The basketball, which she'd dribbled a few times and then ignored. Their bikes, the three of them riding along, waving at neighbors like the happy family they were supposed to be. Rubies with metallic purple tassels streaming from the handles. Betsy laid a hand on Virginia's leg. "We snatched up Ruby's skis for Libby. I probably should have asked you first." Strangers had come in and fingered through their stuff, offered cash, loaded it up in their station wagons, and driven off. A familiar wave of shame and loss rippled through Virginia. Her made-up story about how great her job was, how happy she was a farce. She could no longer tidy everything up, put on a brave face. If she didn't leave now, she'd expose the truth. That in fact, She was a failed temp, relegated to the most basic job in a grungy, dangerous place. A failing mother, struggling to make ends meet. A failed wife. A failed woman. Right now, all she wanted was to take a long shower and wash the grime of Grand Central out of her pores. God knew what lurked in that information booth. The clerks all breathing the same stale air, customers marking up the counters and glass with their dirty fingers. At one point that day, around noon, a single shaft of sunlight had seeped in from one of the high half-moon windows, the only one that hadn't been painted over, streaming in like a beam from heaven. Virginia had stared at it, transfixed, until she realized that she was really looking at all the cigarette smoke and dust particles that hovered in the air. A sparkling ray of filth, an illuminated pollution. Chapter 6. November 1974. But if I don't have a dark room, I can't print my photos. Ruby threw herself face down on Virginia's bed. Virginia watched her daughter through the mirror of her vanity while trying to clip a rhinestone onto one earlobe. Ruby had figured out early on that the best time to ask for something was when Virginia was most vulnerable, when she was rushed, like now, or stressed, like now. Back when Ruby was a little girl, she'd lie on the bed and watch Virginia get ready for a night out on the town, laughing with glee when Virginia touched a dot of perfume on the inside of her daughter's pale, delicate wrist. Since then, Virginia's daughter had lengthened and filled out into a creature she sometimes wasn't sure she recognized. A beautiful, changeable creature, with caramel brown hair down to her waist and big hazel eyes. Not to mention the stubbornness of a bull. Virginia's first date since the divorce was in 45 minutes. When Dennis had stopped by the information booth that morning, only her second day on the job, and asked her out, she'd been both embarrassed and pleased. He'd rapped hard on the glass to get her attention. Terence and Toto had exchanged looks, and she'd quietly stepped out to chat with him, elated to be pursued by such a dashing man. When Doris inquired about him, she'd simply said, "He's with Penn Central. We used to work together." They had, for about 10 minutes, so it wasn't a lie. Virginia knew needling her daughter wasn't the best tactic, but she couldn't help herself. If you hadn't dropped out of school this semester, you'd have a dark room at Sarah Lawrence. Ruby turned her head to the side. "Yes, Mom. I remember where I went to school." "Well, it'll still be there if you decide to go back in January, so you'll just have to hold out until then." When she'd picked Ruby up at school only a few weeks into the semester, she expected to bring her home for a long weekend at most, to make her favorite meals and offer some maternal advice before sending her right back. But Ruby had steadfastly refused to return to school, saying she was only going to fail if she did, so what was the point? In the end, Ruby's tear-stained face and abject misery had warranted a stronger plan of action, one that Chester loudly objected to: withdraw for the semester and look for a less rigorous program. Virginia still held a small sliver of hope that Ruby would decide to give Sarah Lawrence another try in the spring. She'd given up so easily, so early. The official school withdrawal slip still sat on Virginia's desk, unsent. Yet the girl had always struggled in school, socially and academically. And Virginia was fairly certain the only reason she got into Sarah Lawrence in the first place was that Chester's mother had pulled some strings. Virginia often fretted that her own worries about fitting in had rubbed off on her daughter. Throughout high school, Ruby had maneuvered through the world behind the safety of a camera lens. The yearbook was full of her photos of her classmates, the debate team, the theater club, but none of Ruby. Other than the official school photo, which, for some reason, broke Virginia's heart. Her daughter's angelic face raised at a slight angle, as if in disbelief that someone's attention was on her, her eyes bright with excitement. When Virginia asked Ruby what she'd been thinking of, Ruby had said she'd been chatting with a professional photographer about f-stops and apertures. They'd grown even closer after Chester left. But now their relationship was fraying. Ruby had become irritable and secretive, disappearing for hours at a time. She fumed and stormed off whenever Virginia asked about going back to Sarah Lawrence or transferring into a new school. And now this. "I need money to help pay for the darkroom. We're going to set it up ourselves." "Who is this we you refer to?" Virginia wiped off the lipstick she'd just applied, too pink. Best to stick to her everyday rose. "It's a group downtown, like an art collective." Smart girl, that Ruby, to bring up the artistic angle in her argument. Virginia's first love was art history, which she'd studied at Barnard, specializing in medieval art. But she wouldn't be swayed so easily. "I would have to meet these people first. I'm sure you understand my concerns." Ruby scowled. "They're not like that. They'll laugh at me and kick me out if I say that they have to come uptown and meet my mom." Her eyes narrowed. "You've been on my case for not doing anything these past 2 months. Now I'm working with my hands, making something real, and you don't like that either." She had a point. She was 19, after all. It was nice to see her striking out on her own, following an artistic passion. Virginia hated to shoot her down. "How much?" $100. Virginia turned to face her, her mouth open. "You're kidding, right? What on earth do you need $100 for?" "I told you, to set up a professional darkroom. We're all chipping in." "You're being swindled." "No. Even if I had the money, I wouldn't give it to you. Where is this art collective you go to?" "The East Village. East 6th Street." Had she lost her mind? Virginia pictured a group of heroin addicts shooting up in an abandoned building, eyeing Ruby and her camera as easy prey. "It's dangerous down there. I don't like the idea of you wandering around that neighborhood." "God, I'm not a child anymore." "Forget it, then." Ruby bounded off the bed and out of the room, her exit punctuated by the slamming of her bedroom door. Her daughter was lost, searching for some meaning in her life, and Virginia knew what that was like. She shouldn't have overreacted. Ruby didn't know how much they were struggling financially. Virginia had shielded her from the truth as much as possible, calling her job hunt a fun lark. She dreaded introducing the additional stress into her daughter's life. But for now, she was late for her date. The restaurant Dennis had chosen was located close to Grand Central, which made sense since he lived on the Hudson line. Virginia knew it took around 30 minutes to get to the Yonkers stop, depending on whether you were traveling at peak hours. Not a bad commute. He was already inside, near the back, at a booth. He stood and kissed her on the cheek, a mix of soap and aftershave she'd always found appealing. The scent brought back memories of hot summer nights up on the roof of her parents' apartment building, necking with her high school crush. Dennis ordered a wine for her and a beer for him.
"You been staying out of trouble, little missy?" he asked.
"Luckily, yes."
"I bought you a present,"
Her heart thumped as he reached into his coat pocket. She hadn't received a gift from a man in ages. Whenever it had been her birthday, she'd gone out and bought herself whatever she wanted and told Chester what he'd gotten her, so as not to be disappointed by his forgetting the day entirely. Dennis placed a can of something on the table.
Mace, for your protection.
Not what she'd expected. Still, how thoughtful and practical.
How's the job going so far?
He passed a menu to her. She searched for something interesting to say that might impress him. I've been reading through the handbook for info booth clerks. Did you know that there's a newsreel theater opposite Track 17? And that until the 1960s, CBS had a television studio in Grand Central?
Sure did. You can't surprise me with anything about that place. I know it all. But why are you learning about stuff from the 1960s? It's not like a passenger is going to come up and ask that.
Oh, we get all kinds of strange questions. You'd be surprised. But the handbook is ancient, probably from the 1950s. Whenever it needs updating, Terrence just adds in more pages at the front. I like the older stuff, to be honest. Finding out what it was like way back when. There's even a photo of the information booth back before the terminal opened to the public. Turns out the metal frame on top is supposed to be shiny brass, not black. In fact, after studying the photo, she'd picked up some brass cleaner during her break and spent the afternoon wiping down the exterior detailing until it reflected her face back to her. Toto and Doris, the most caustic of the booth's employees, had snickered at her while she worked. But she didn't care. Terrence had given her a thumbs up from behind the window. She shrugged. Anyway, it's a job. I'm not sure I'm much help. They both ordered the shepherd's pie, then clinked glasses. How do you like working for Penn Central? She asked.
It's interesting enough. My grandfather was a conductor, so we have a family legacy in the railroad, you could say. But that was back when train travel was something special. Did you know that they used to roll out a red carpet for passengers on the 20th Century Limited, which ran between Chicago and New York? That's where the phrase, roll out the red carpet, comes from.
Virginia smiled at his boyish excitement. You're a real train buff, then.
Even had an electric train set as a kid. I loved that thing.
He took another swig of beer.
Ironic that I'm the one ripping the place apart.
She thought of her ladies' committee, how the historian had spoken with such reverence about the architecture. Do you have to rip it apart?
Time marches on. There's no money to fix it up. So the alternative is to let it collapse in a heap.
I guess we don't want that. How soon do you think they'll start building the skyscraper?
Whenever the court case wraps up. Hopefully next year.
Terrific. I'll make sure my steno is up to snuff by then. A cloud of confusion crossed his face. For my new job, remember? He laughed, and she breathed a sigh of relief.
Of course. We can't have you stuck in that information booth forever. You can count on me to get this building up and running. It's in the bag.
How's that?
I'm working with the numbers guy, and it's all about the numbers.
He leaned in, as if the waiter was in danger of eavesdropping.
We've put together the financials to show the terminal's upkeep is a huge burden on Penn Central. One that's draining all our resources. These liberals say it should be a landmark. But it's not like we get any economic benefits from the landmark designation. It's killing us. Once we win, we'll use the building as a base for something better. Just like the Romans used to layer villages one right on top of another.
The reference to ancient Rome made her less worried about the idea of the terminal being totally subsumed. Progress, then?
Progress. Just goes to show that you can be a corporate stiff and be creative at the same time.
What do you mean?
Let's just say we've had to massage the numbers some to increase the likelihood the court decides in our favor.
Is that legal?
He laughed. We're lawyers. Of course it's legal.
She poured a good helping of ketchup on the edge of her shepherd's pie as Dennis changed the subject to his favorite television shows. They both liked MASH, and she made him laugh with her impression of the uptight nurse Margaret Houlihan. She told him he reminded her of Trapper John.
You're easy to talk to.
He took the bill from the waiter and reached for his wallet.
Even if you can't surprise me with anything when it comes to Grand Central, you're talking to the expert here.
She racked her brain for something he might not know. Did you know about the ghost?
What ghost?
There's a ghost that haunts the old art school up in the east wing of the 7th floor.
What art school? That's all storage space.
She'd got him. The map of the terminal calls it a storage space, but in fact, it's a school of art, frozen in time. I was in there yesterday. I took a wrong turn on the way to the bathroom, and it's amazing inside. Later, the guys in the info booth told me that it's haunted.
Is that so?
She couldn't hide her delight at his surprise. So there. I've topped you. I know something you don't.
You could be fooling me.
He reached across the table and took her hand, rubbing his thumb so lightly over her skin she shivered.
Prove it.
You want me to show it to you? It means returning to the scene of the crime.
You up for that? I'll take care of you. I promise.
Was that a double meaning behind his words?
Come on. Now you've got me intrigued. Let's go explore.
Virginia had second thoughts as Dennis led her across the concourse. He squeezed her hand and pulled her slightly closer to him, as if he sensed her reluctance. Anyone in their right mind would be reluctant, entering Grand Central after hours like this, when the mob of commuters had thinned out. The waiting room, never safe on a good day, was filled with homeless people lying on benches, some even stretched out on the sticky floors. A fight broke out between two of them, something about stolen shoes, and she was glad when they made it safely into the alcove of elevator banks. Dennis pressed the button to the 7th floor before pulling her close and landing a soft kiss on her lips. She'd been unprepared and couldn't relax enough to enjoy it. When the elevator doors opened, she pulled back with a giggle of relief. They walked down the hallway, made a right, and she counted to the 4th door before fishing in her pocketbook for the bathroom key, which she'd never returned. Inside, she clicked on the hallway light switch and watched him explore. In the darkened studios, the light from the skyscrapers surrounding the terminal poured in through a line of skylights, giving off an eerie glow.
"Did you see a ghost when you were here?"
Dennis asked. "No, but it's easy to imagine a ghost of an artist wandering through, right?"
"Wearing a beret and a smock, no doubt."
"I think it's wonderful that it's unchanged." There was something romantic about this place, forgotten yet preserved, that pleased her. She touched a set of brushes on a workbench. It seems so odd that people would come up here in a train station to paint.
"You know anything about art?"
"I was an art history major in college, but my focus was on art from the Middle Ages, frescoes and mosaics and that sort of thing."
"I knew you were a smart one."
Dennis had shifted so he was standing behind her, his hands on her waist. She leaned back slightly and pressed her back into him, and he responded by wrapping his arms about her stomach. She hadn't experienced a man's touch for so long, and she'd missed it. They stood together for a while, his chin resting on her head, and as long as she could cover his arms with her own, keep them from sliding up, she was fine. But the thought of him trying to touch her chest made her want to run screaming out of the room. She couldn't reveal the scar to him. It was too long a story to tell. The concerned way her doctor looked at her as he prodded her breast. The visit to the oncologist, to the surgeon. Trying to remember what they were saying and then putting a positive spin on it over dinner with Chester and Ruby. The lovely sensation of going under on the operating table, like she'd just drunk 7 martinis, followed by the pain and confusion of waking up. The recovery, putting on a brave face with Ruby when she came home from school that first week at home, pretending that she wasn't in terrible pain and refusing to take the pills the doctor had prescribed because she didn't want to lose control. For once, here in this strange room with practically a stranger, she wanted to lose control. Everyone else did these days. Why couldn't she indulge like most of America was doing, from the suburban key parties to the sex clubs downtown? Because she was deformed. No one would want to touch her. "You're beautiful," he murmured as he slid his hands upward. If she had to distract him with another body part, so be it. Virginia leaned down and pulled up her skirt, turning her head to look at him with what she hoped was an enticing smile. Dennis stepped back, caught off guard. Her actions made her look like a brazen hussy, as her mother would have said, but at least they kept his hands off her chest. A hunger in his eyes soon replaced his surprise, and he ran his hands along her bare thighs, slowly. Now, this wasn't so bad after all. She'd forgotten the kind of electricity that passed between two people when they were on the precipice of something new. Just to her right stood a large storage cabinet. She slid sideways and hinged slightly at the waist, placing her hands on the shelf in front of her. While Dennis fumbled behind her, she caught sight of a tattered copy of Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse on the shelf at eye level. Virginia had read it in college, and for the first time all semester raised her hand during class. She couldn't remember what she'd said, but low snickers had traveled around the room when she mispronounced the CH and nonchalance as a hard K sound. She'd never heard the word spoken out loud, only read it in books. The embarrassment had derailed her confidence the rest of the year, until she'd met Chester. From the sounds Dennis made, he seemed to be enjoying himself immensely, and that made her happy, even if she didn't feel the same heat. Not yet, anyway. Maybe next time she'd be less nervous and lose herself the way he was now. Good thing they were isolated back here, as his groans were of a decibel level and pitch that rivaled the folk singers Ruby liked to listen to in her room, her record player's volume turned all the way up. When he finished, he turned her around and held her close. "Amazing." She pulled down her skirt. "It was." He cocked his head toward a lumpy-looking chaise longue pushed against one wall. "Come lie down with me for a moment. I want to cuddle." A man who liked to cuddle. How could she say no? They settled in, both lying on their sides. Virginia perched on the very edge, trying not to sneeze. Dennis wrapped his hand around her and fell promptly asleep. Not what she'd expected when she'd gotten ready that evening. She'd imagined them at a candle-lit dinner, him giving her a chaste but yearning kiss and putting her in a cab afterward. The hint of something more on both their lips. Yet there she was, huddled on an old couch in a forgotten ghostly art school. What the hell? She was proud of herself. This is what life was like as a divorcee in the 70s. It's what all the books and movies talked about. Quickie sex with someone you just met. Already she was rewriting the scene in her head for the next time she saw Betsy. A gal on the town having a passionate tryst with a stunner of a guy. A shock of color sticking out from the side of the storage cabinet caught her eye. Cobalt blue, on what looked like a corner of drawing paper that was wedged between the back of the cabinet and the wall, at knee level. Quietly, carefully, she disentangled herself from Dennis's arms and extricated the paper from behind the cabinet. On one side was a pencil drawing of a glamorous woman that looked like it was from the 1920s or 30s. The woman lay on the same chaise longue Dennis was currently stretched out on, her limbs long and languorous. At the very bottom was a signature, Clara Darden, the artist who'd sketched the secretary advertisement from the other room. The paper was stiffer than the others, and when Virginia turned it over, she saw the reason. The other side was covered in paint, the blue that she'd spied from the sofa. Watercolors, she guessed. The figure vaguely resembled the well-dressed woman on the other side, but with more movement and color. It both horrified her and drew her in. Something terrible, violent, was going on, but the shapes weren't clear. She tiptoed into the storage room and found the drawing of the secretaries that had caught her eye the day before. Both shared the same signature, Clara Darden. But something was off. It took her a minute to realize that the wall of art had changed. A few of the paintings she'd seen yesterday were missing, replaced by others, including the Renoir reproduction with the soda bottle. She looked around for it. Nothing was on the floor. It hadn't fallen off. Someone had rearranged things. The ghost? She told herself not to be silly. Probably the cleaning crew messing around. No. The place was covered in dust. No cleaning crew had been inside the school in decades. She studied the painting in her hand. She'd seen it before. But where? The audaciousness and the blue colors pleased her. The woman figure was bold, just as Virginia had been lately, taking risks, a shapeshifter. If she took it, would anyone care or notice? Probably not. The painting had been stuck behind a cabinet for this long and would have eventually disintegrated if she hadn't spotted it. Instead, she could save it, preserve it. Framed, the painting would fill a blank space in her living room, one that had bothered Virginia ever since she'd moved in. It would serve as a reminder to stay strong and welcome change into her life. Virginia rolled it up and carefully tucked it inside her sisal handbag before waking her sleeping giant with a kiss. Chapter 7, May 1928. Clara had seen Levon only twice since he'd taken her class 5 days earlier. Once in a crowded hallway where he'd given her a salute as he brushed by, and another time on the concourse of the terminal, where she was certain he'd spotted her but pretended not to. His puerile behavior annoyed her. She had no way of knowing if he'd upheld his end of the bet and insisted that Mr. Lorette keep her on. But the signs were promising, Mr. Lorette had pulled her aside as she was leaving yesterday and told her that he'd arranged a live model for her illustration class the next day. She jumped at the opportunity and altered her lesson plans accordingly. As she entered the school the next morning, Oliver was sitting in one of the chairs outside Mr. Lorette's office. She'd secretly hoped he would be her model while also fearing it. She'd intended to start with the model in the nude, but there was no possible way Gertrude and the others would be able to focus if this man disrobed. She wouldn't be able to either. It was one thing to be a student, tucked behind an easel, but another entirely to be the instructor out in front discussing grids and proportions. And what proportions? Absolutely not. Oliver, lovely to see you, she swallowed. Again? Miss Darden, I hope you weren't too put off by my modeling here. Nadine had suggested it. She said it would be a good way to meet artists. Break into the bohemian crowd, if you will.
No doubt she did.
Anyway, would you like me to change into a robe?
He wore a polished wool flannel suit in dark brown, his slim figure perfect for the fashionably wide Oxford trousers.
No. We'll draw what you have on. See you inside.
She spent the first 15 minutes pointing out the details she expected the class to capture in their drawings, tugging on the jacket's lapel as she explained the best approach. You'll want to do the suit in an opaque wash and the hat and face with a transparent one. She adjusted his tie and stepped back. Would you mind putting one hand in a pocket? He did so, his eyes shining as if posing were a delight, not a physical ordeal. Standing still wasn't easy, and she appreciated his enthusiasm.
Whatever you need, Miss Darden.
He winked at her, and the class giggled. She would not be made fun of. Why should she get flustered and feel strange when the male teachers never did? If a female model flirted with Levon, he probably flirted right back. She reached up and touched his face, adjusted his hat. This was power, to be the one in control. She liked it, and didn't care if her students noticed. Let them talk.
I suggest you use a Gillette 170 pen point for the figure and add the black with a number 8 brush.
She scanned his body one last time and then began making the rounds. The rest of the class went smoothly, and the students turned in some of their best work yet. Finally, their drawings showed more than two dimensions. After dismissal, she stopped by Mr. Lorette's office, but before she could express her gratitude, he asked her to step inside and close the door. She spoke first.
I'd like to thank you for allowing a live model in our class. The work was terrific. I hope you'll stop by and see.
Right. Good to hear. I want to let you know that we'd like you to carry on in the fall with the illustration class. There will be two sessions, one on Tuesday and Thursday mornings and another in the afternoons. You can have both.
He threw out the words as if they were part of a script, not heartfelt. But Levon had made good on his bet. Even if Mr. Lorette was keeping her on against his better judgment, it was no matter. She'd have money to buy more time in New York City, as long as she made it through the summer.
Thank you. That's wonderful news. Are there any summer classes available?
She knew she was pushing it, but better to ask than not.
We bring a small number of students and teachers to Maine in the summer, so no.
Fine. She'd manage.
Also, you'll be giving out the illustration award tomorrow night at the May Ball, correct?
The ball, held in the art galleries, was an annual event for students and faculty. Student work was displayed and awards were announced. Clara had been dreading going, but now, with the news she'd be staying on at the school, she didn't mind. Yes,
Looking forward to it.
A student barged in, complaining to Mr. Lorette about a missing artwork.
I spent 5 weeks on it, and it was finally finished, drying overnight, and now it's gone.
Now then, Cyril, I'm sure we'll track it down.
Same thing happened to Graham Hanover earlier in the term, Mr. Lorette. It's an epidemic.
Let's not be too dramatic now. Come inside. Tell me what's going on.
Mr. Lorette waved Clara off. She thanked him once more before heading out.
Outside the office, Oliver stood speaking with three of her students, all of whom looked as if they wanted to devour him whole. She heard Oliver laugh and say goodbye to his fan club. He caught up with her in front of the elevator.
Where are you off to?
The arrow above the elevator door hit 5. She was heading home. Of course, as she always did, day after day.
Why do you ask?
I'd like to take you somewhere surprising.
I'm sure Gertrude or one of the others would be pleased to accompany you.
He laughed.
Not them. You.
She wanted to get back to her studio and work. But his excitement intrigued her, and she was flattered by his interest.
You don't have to leave Grand Central, Miss Darden. Even better, the crowd is an illustrator's dream. Will you come?
An illustrator's dream. She nodded and let him take her elbow as the elevator doors opened. They crossed the concourse and went up the stairs of the west balcony.
I thought you said we didn't have to leave Grand Central, said Clara,
as he ushered her out the doors that led to Vanderbilt Avenue.
Not exactly.
He made a sharp left up a narrow staircase to a set of wrought iron doors.
What is this place?
You'll see.
Inside the doorway stood a man holding a tray of glasses filled with bubbles. It couldn't be.
Champagne?
Oliver put a finger to his lips.
Not at all. Prohibition, remember?
Right.
She took the glass he offered her and let him lead her through a small anteroom, where she stopped cold. She was no longer in the heart of New York City, but in a 13th-century Florentine palazzo, the floor covered by a massive Persian rug. The painted wood ceiling soared a good 20 feet above her head, and everywhere were strange treasures. 6-foot-tall vases, bronze sculptures, petrified tree trunks, and up in a balcony, what appeared to be a pipe organ.
What on earth is this?
It's called the Campbell Apartment, but it's an office.
For someone who works for the railroad.
She imagined a Vanderbilt installed here, running the trains from this magnificent headquarters.
Not really. A financier who's on the board of New York Central. He likes to throw parties every so often. I thought you'd get a kick out of it.
More than a kick. This place is breathtaking.
She took a sip from the glass. The real thing.
How did you get in here?
I know someone who knows someone.
A woman in a peach-colored chiffon gown spotted Oliver, and Clara watched as she drank him in, her fat cat husband oblivious to his wife's greedy leering. New York City was full of people like Oliver. Beautiful men and women used to being stared at, who politely looked away so you could drink in your fill of exquisite cheekbones or blue eyes. In Oliver's case, both features. When the woman's eyes shifted to Clara, they registered something else entirely. Disdain. As someone who was used to being gawked at for her height and her awkwardness, Clara knew the other side of the coin. Her defense was to stare back, widen her eyes, run her hands through her hair so it stuck up more than usual. She did so, hard, until the woman turned away.
When Clara turned back to Oliver, she caught her reflection in a smoky mirror on the wall.
No wonder she drew stares. Her serviceable broadcloth frock had a rip in the elbow and the hem was coming loose. She'd meant to fix it, but had never gotten around to it. She looked like a waif from the streets.
Before they'd moved to Tucson, when times were flush, Clara had watched her mother dress for balls and dinner parties. Truth be told, it would have been easier if she didn't know how badly she stood out, if she were naive when it came to fashion and class. She'd enjoy herself, ignorant and blissful, pleased to have gained entry to high society, instead of wishing she could crawl underneath the massive antique desk and hide. She turned back to Oliver, wanting to focus on anything else but herself.
Tell me about your family. They don't appreciate having a poet for a son.
I'm afraid not. I could tell when we first met that you understood what that feels like. Trying to please for so many years and then ultimately disappointing.
She certainly did. But your mother, she must be happy at your chosen path.
Quietly, she might be. But she married into wealth and subverted all her creativity. She'd adore you, though. You're her dream. A woman artist out in the world. Not easy, I presume.
You presume correctly. If he only knew. The champagne was making her tipsy, as though she could float away. Another woman looked her up and down dismissively. Boy, was Oliver lucky. Money and looks. Quite a combo, even if he didn't appreciate it now. Could you give me an example of your work?
Now?
Why not?
He paused, then spoke in a clear, soft voice. Thin-fingered twigs clutch darkly at nothing. Crackling skeletons shine. Along the smutted horizon of Fifth Avenue, the hooded houses watch heavily with oily gold eyes.
There was more to this sweet pea than she expected. She swallowed, trying to hide her shock. What's a smutted horizon?
He threw back his head and laughed.
I'm not sure. I have to confess, those aren't my words. It's a poem called Autumn Dusk in Central Park by Evelyn Scott.
She tried to take this turn in stride.
It's remarkable.
I don't have any of mine memorized. They're more of a work in progress. You put me on the spot, and I was desperate to show off.
Why would you be wanting to impress me?
What a coy thing to say. Tingled by champagne, she was coming off as silly as Gertrude or Nadine. She continued before he replied,
You've been blessed with wealth and education, so I'm not sure what the problem is.
Write your poems and get on with it already.
He grinned.
You've summed it up perfectly. Yet I'm dismissed by the artistic set for my wealth and by the wealthy set for my artistic aspirations.
The words came out as a statement, not a complaint. But underneath lay a whiff of misery, the same she would have felt if she'd remained in Arizona, her creativity squelched. The droning of the organ stopped, and a man with a tall forehead and hooded eyes leaned one hand against the imposing stone fireplace and asked for everyone's attention. Apparently, this was the famous Mr. Campbell, who had an office that he called an apartment in the middle of Grand Central. He thanked everyone for stopping by, and when he finished, the crowd clapped with gusto. The alcohol certainly helped in this regard. Clara looked to the exit, hoping they could sidle their way out.
My dear Oliver!
A skinny older woman snapped her head in between them, blinking hard at Oliver. Her dusky fur, which hung loosely over her shoulders, was the same color as her hair, and the overall effect was that of a posh ferret.
Oliver opened his mouth to reply, but the woman spoke first.
Mr. Campbell and I were wondering if you were going to appear. Where have you been gadding about these days, and with whom?
She peered at Clara.
I get my answer right off. You are an artist, I'm guessing.
How did you know?
Asked Clara.
The smudge of something on your cheek and on your hands. We've been worried about our Oliver slumming in the village.
She chuckled.
Oh, ignore me. I'm being a silly goose.
Clara swiped at her cheek and glared at Oliver.
Now, Oliver, my dear nephew, we must see you more often up in Rye.
She droned on about an upcoming race at the yacht club, while Clara fumed. Finally, the woman sauntered off.
Why didn't you tell me I had paint on my face?
Clara growled. Bad enough I'm not dressed correctly. She turned to go, but he took her hand and pulled her up a small staircase to where the organ sat. The organist was packing up his music and barely regarded them before slipping away. She stomped away from Oliver, staring down over the balcony. He cleared his throat.
I'm sorry for making you feel awkward. That wasn't my intention at all. I just wanted you to see this place, to share it with you. I wanted to impress you with the room, not the people.
Oh, please. You're one of them. Why bother pretending to be a poor poet?
I'm not pretending anything. I don't want to be known for this.
He gestured out over the crowd.
I want my work to stand on its own.
Why poetry?
Why art?
She thought about it for a moment. Because I have a passion for it and I can make money doing it. Or so I thought.
What's got you stuck?
I don't have connections. I can't seem to break in.
And I can't break out.
He looked dejected, beat.
I'd rather be like Walt Whitman, a working man, than an overeducated twit who loves verse.
She couldn't help but laugh.
Your idea of being a working man is taking off your clothes in front of a bunch of artists.
If that means I can meet people like Levon Zakarian and Sebastian Standish, then yes. Unfortunately, that crowd doesn't let in outsiders easily, especially not guys like me.
He had a point. They were a caustic, judgmental bunch, herself included. Oliver touched her hand.
I loved watching you teach. I never know what you'll say or do next. You're brimming with confidence, and that's not something you see every day in a gal. Do you happen to be in the market for a muse?
She tried not to smile. They tend not to come to very good ends, you know. Artists are a fickle lot.
I can hold my own.
Can you? He leaned in and kissed her. Having never been kissed before, she was eager to see what the fuss was all about. They were about the same height, and at first it felt strange, like kissing a mirror image. But he pulled her to him and explored her mouth with his tongue. It was glorious, the sensations and the wetness of their mouths, the quiet moans. The warmth of his touch was all too accessible through the thin fabric of her dress. But her mother's admonition to be careful, spoken in a hushed voice up in Clara's bedroom the evening before her trip east, stuck in her head. She pulled away, laughing. He looked hurt.
"I'm not laughing at you. That was marvelous," she said.
"Then why laugh?"
Because I've never met anyone like you before. You are so beautiful.
His mouth turned down.
You keep saying that.
It's the truth. You belong with some pretty little child,
one of my witless students, perhaps.
Not with me.
Why don't you see us together? I can help you.
She regarded him.
What do you want from me in return? Nothing. Nothing at all.
He kissed her again, pulling away just as the heat began to build.
Say, there is one thing.
I knew it.
Will you go to the May Ball with me tomorrow night?
Clara imagined showing up on Oliver's arm, returning to the scene of last week's humiliation with her head held high, and said yes. Chapter 8, May 1928. Clara had planned on wearing her nicest frock to the May Ball, a sensible two-piece crepe de chine, the same one she'd worn to the exhibit a little over a week ago. But that morning, Oliver rang her apartment and offered to buy her something special.
"My first role is muse," he'd said with a laugh.
She considered his offer. The tepid reception at the Campbell apartment still rankled Clara, and tonight she wanted to shine, to show Mr. Lorette and Lavon and the rest of them that she was someone to be taken seriously. A new dress would help. She'd expected a trip to Wanamaker or Lord & Taylor, but Oliver brought her to a small shop on Fifth Avenue with the name Peggy Hoyt on the window. Clara steeled herself before entering. Peggy Hoyt was a marvel at gown design, far beyond the reach of any starving artist. Peggy Hoyt gowns got mentioned in the social columns of the newspapers with regularity. The women who wore them were all dolled up in diamonds and smug smiles, knowing they counted in the world. To her surprise, there were no dresses in sight. It was as if they'd stepped inside someone's dark, quiet living room, with thick silk curtains and a rose-covered chaise angled toward a marble fireplace. A middle-aged woman wearing a simple black suit appeared from a back room. She greeted Oliver warmly and offered a kind smile to Clara.
"Miss Hoyt sends her apologies, but she's in Paris this week. I told her I'd take good care of you, though."
"You're too kind, Mrs. Fletcher, and Clara and I appreciate your accommodating us on such short notice." Oliver was quite the man about town, comfortable in his own skin and as elegant as Mr. Campbell. No wonder he'd been rejected by the hard-nosed poets of Greenwich Village as a dandy, a dire mismatch of personality and profession. Mrs. Fletcher guided Clara to the back of the shop.
"You have the perfect figure for a Peggy Hoyt dress, I have to say."
She began pulling gowns from a rack. "Long and lean." Clara shook her head.
"I'm far too tall. I doubt any of them will fit me."
When she was 16 and still squeezing into two small clothes, as there was no money to replace them, she'd stolen a pair of stable hands overalls to work in the vegetable garden. The freedom of movement exhilarated her, as did the fact that she could finally take a deep breath without feeling pinched in the waist. Until her mother had caught sight of her and howled like a coyote, and Clara retreated inside to change. Mrs. Fletcher responded with a reassuring smile.
"We'll find the right thing, don't you worry. In fact, there's one gown in particular that I think will look smashing on you. Here it is."
She held up an aquamarine silk with a chiffon overlay embroidered with copper-colored thread. The threading extended in a peacock feather design from just below the waist to the hem of the dress, where gold and silver beading formed the eyes of each feather. A similar beading adorned the neckline, rendering a necklace superfluous. Clara prayed for it to fit. It did, the inner lining slipping over her hips with ease, the hem brushing just below her knees.
"It's perfect."
She'd been holding her breath since spying it in Mrs. Fletcher's arms, and her voice came out in an unladylike exhale. Mrs. Fletcher laughed.
Most women would be overpowered by the peacock design, but you have the height and authority to carry it off.
She walked into the other room, where Oliver sat reading the newspaper as if they were an old married couple who did this kind of thing every other week. He jumped out of the chair like a jack-in-the-box, the paper fluttering to the floor.
You look astonishing.
Doesn't she? Asked Mrs. Fletcher. We have shoes and an evening bag as well.
We'll take it all. Put it on my family's account, please. After slipping out of the dress and handing it over to Mrs. Fletcher to wrap, Clara rejoined Oliver. For all she knew, Clara was one of a line of creative women whom Oliver took under his wing, bought trinkets and gowns for, and then dropped when his artistic ambitions didn't come to fruition. Clara's mother would be horrified at the thought of her daughter being dressed and kissed by a man, even a wealthy man, when any intentions were strictly non-marital. But the world had changed. Free love wasn't necessarily as outrageous, at least among the Bohemians, as it might have been 10 years ago. Just as waistlines had disappeared from fashion, the restrictions of courting had loosened considerably, at least in New York, and among the more scandalous set. Oliver broke into her thoughts.
I know this seems crazy, but I'd like you to meet my mother.
Your mother?
Yes, I'm expected for tea at my parents' in a half hour. I know you'll hit it off, and it would help. You're a real working artist, and it would give her a lift that she sorely needs.
That seems rather fast. All thoughts of having Oliver take her to his apartment and make love to her dissipated. With disappointment, she had to admit. In the end, she relented, after he described the fresh scones to be served. Her diet the past many months had been one of baked beans and cold meats. High tea at Oliver's parents, no matter how it went or why he was so insistent she go, would be an extra meal she didn't have to pay for. His motives for the visit worried her, though. As he ushered her inside the elevator of a handsome limestone apartment building. What if he was doing this to shock his parents, show them what a bad boy he was, hobnobbing with the arty set? Better to be aware of his immaturity sooner rather than later, she supposed. If so, she'd at least gotten a swanky dress out of the deal. The operator pulled the lever to bring them up to the 10th floor, and shared an easy repartee with Oliver, ribbing him about his muddy shoes and how much dirt he was tracking inside. Oliver didn't take offense, joking back that he'd return with a broom and clean it right up, like he used to do as a little boy.
I wanted to work as a doorman since I was about 3, I'd say,
he told Clara, turning to the operator for confirmation.
I'd dress in my fanciest suit and join them in the lobby, holding the door open and greeting the residents.
The very idea made her smile. They stepped off into a wide hallway with a marble floor, the door slamming hard behind them. I'm surprised your parents allowed it.
My father didn't know. He was off working. My mother, well, you'll see.
The minute Clara entered the apartment, a more feminine, older version of Oliver greeted them.
Oliver?
She looked over at Clara, confused.
Mother, I'd like to introduce you to a friend of mine, Miss Clara Darden, who's on the faculty of the Grand Central School of Art. Miss Darden is an esteemed illustrator.
An artist? Aren't we lucky?
She was a ghost of a woman, thin and pale, a suggestion of sadness in her mouth and eyes, which were the same blue as her son's. Her hand in Clara's was cool, her fingers fragile and light. Oliver placed a protective hand on his mother's shoulder.
I told her you also paint.
She shook her head.
used to paint, in my youth, not anymore. But my goodness, you teach art. Are there many women teachers?
Just me. A much older man with a rheumatic cough and milky eyes emerged from a doorway without bothering to acknowledge the stranger in the room.
Come, I'd like to drink my tea before the sun sets.
His voice rumbled like the subway. Underneath the pillowy folds of his face and neck, Clara recognized the slice of Oliver's cheekbones. If there were two more mismatched spouses in the city, Clara would be surprised. After introductions, the four settled at a dining room table with a sweeping view of Central Park. It was all Clara could do to keep her gaze on the table's occupants and not get distracted by the lush carpet of new green leaves outside the window. April had been a dull, rainy month, and she hadn't ventured uptown in a while. The bright pink shock of cherry blooms excited her. She wished she could just stand at the window and drink in the colors of spring. Mrs. Smith beamed as a maid passed around the plate of warm scones.
How long have you been teaching at Grand Central?
Since January. I started as a student last fall.
A quick promotion?
I suppose. The tinkling of silverware on china and the way the scone melted in her mouth brought memories rushing back. After all, she'd been raised in luxury and in many ways felt at home here more than in her stark artist's garret. While the ostentatiousness of the Campbell apartment had thrown her off balance, the Smith's refinement closely mirrored her mother's.
I did love painting.
Mrs. Smith dabbed at a crumb that had fallen onto the tablecloth.
I never could get people right. Faces seemed to elude me, but I loved painting landscapes. Turner's my favorite. The way he paints the sea and the sky, simply breathtaking.
Cologne from the river, suggested Clara. Both women sighed at the same time, then laughed.
Never mind that.
Mr. Smith's gruff voice practically rattled the Tuscan china.
Where do you come from? Where's your family?
Oliver threw her an apologetic look.
Father, you don't know anyone in common, so don't start fishing to see if she's a debutante.
Clara wasn't about to let Oliver speak for her. My family is in Copper. We've invested in several mines out west, including a lucrative arrangement with the Brawleys of Phoenix. Perhaps you're acquainted with them? Mr. Smith sat back, suspicious.
I don't know them personally, but of course I've heard of them.
He looked over at his wife.
Own the biggest mines in the country.
Clara launched into a protracted explanation of the speculative copper industry out west and her father's partnership with the Brawleys, watching with satisfaction as the man's eyes widened with surprise. Her father had taught her well. Of course, she skipped the part about his attempt to swindle the Brawleys out of thousands of dollars. Hopefully, enough time had passed that the fraud was no longer remembered outside of Maricopa County. Oliver, laughing, finally cut her off.
Enough about metals. Father seems to have met his match.
He turned to his parents.
Miss Darden and I have a ball to attend, and I was hoping she could get dressed here.
No, I couldn't intrude. Please, we insist.
Mrs. Smith practically levitated from the table with excitement.
My rose can set hair like no one else in this town, and you can borrow whatever you need, lipstick, rouge, I have it all.
That would be lovely. By the time the maid was finished with her, Clara could hardly contain her surprise. She thanked the woman profusely and entered the parlor where Oliver waited.
You look exquisite.
Oliver stuttered over the last word.
Her hair, set in regular waves along her skull instead of flying about, was like a sleek helmet. The beads of the dress gave it a weight that offset the silky lightness of the fabric, and she'd borrowed a pair of pearl-colored gloves to go with her shoes. For once, her height worked in her favor, just as Mrs. Fletcher in the shop had predicted. She was a smooth, aquamarine column of elegance. Mr. Smith took her hands in both of his to say goodbye and